in to talk to this group. I wanted to tell you this talk will be a bit schizophrenic in that we're going to talk about both cows and mice at the same time. And so hopefully it will not be too confusing when I'm talking about one versus the other. I'll remember to let you know. We're going to start out talking about the bovine model, and then we're going to switch to talk about mice, and we'll come back and talk about bovine again. In 2005, and standing here listening, or sitting there listening to Dorian talk, it occurred to me that it would be worth mentioning that in 2005 was the breakthrough with next-generation sequencing and the advent of next-generation sequencing that really led to a lot of the capacity for generating the type of DNA sequence data that Dorian talked about that's on the genotypic end of the animal. And you're seeing that now manifest in whole genome sequencing being used as a means for genotyping these animals and at least some of the important animals in the pedigrees. It's that same technology breakthrough in that same time period that also allowed for a literal explosion in the area of understanding the microbiome. And so that's what I want to talk to you about today is the microbiome of these animals. So this is the whole other genetic component of these animals that we've really known very, very little about. And it wasn't until we had the capacity to do DNA sequencing at this scale were we able to begin to quantify and really start to understand how these microorganisms operate in these animals. So I hate to tell you, but you are 90% microbes. We know that from studying humans, and we presume, although I haven't seen the quantifications in the bovine models, it's probably much the same in the bovine model as well. So 90% of the genetic content in your body, or probably even a little more than that, and of course 90% of the number of cells in your body are actually microbes. You're only 10% human. I hate to tell you that, but that's the reality that we have to deal with here. So these organisms are contributing lots of things to the different functions in the bodies and the ecosystems in which they operate. So if we look at the bovine microbiome, there's different groups of microorganisms that reside in different areas of the bovine body, and I've just highlighted a few that are relevant and are probably the most interest. Of course, the ruminant microbiome is probably the one that's the most interest to this particular audience because of its role in feed efficiency. It's the primary site for dietary fermentation. But we also have, I guess the pointer is not working here, we also have a lot of interest in the colonic microbiome, and because these are compartmentalized, they probably operate fairly separately and fairly independently. But that colonic microbiome is very important for colonization resistance to pathogens. I'm going to come back and talk about that towards the end of the talk. So if we can begin to understand how that colonic microbiome works, there's probably things there that are at least of some relevance to this audience, certainly of relevance to the meat market in general. And then others with respect to health and disease in these animals, the oropharynx, just for example, in relationship to BRD. And of course, the udder microbiome would be on the skin or on the udder. This relationship to mastitis. So as we begin to think about these environments now, we have this whole other component of organisms now that we can study in these environments, and we can begin to see how they're functioning in these environments and how that function contributes to very important traits in these animals. So highlighted here is sort of an overview of the ruminant fermentation process, and I'm sure most of you in this room are familiar with this. But I put this up because this is a place at which a lot of the microbiology for understanding how these communities operate actually began. And it was really back in the 1960s when Marvin Bryant was able to define that there was actually interspecies hydrogen transfer that was occurring between two very different types of bacteria. And those are shown down there at the bottom of the manogenic archaea. and some of the organisms that are up in the acetogenic and the hydrolytic bacteria. But essentially, you're looking at consortia of bacteria, communities of bacteria that work together and collectively to break down the dietary components that are brought in. And so the protein, especially the carbohydrate components, are broken down by groups of hydrolytic bacteria. There's many different species that can fulfill this role, and you'll see that, I'll show that to you in a minute. But there's a lot of functional redundancy built into the genomes of these species. The hydrolytic bacteria then break those down to compounds, amino acids, monosaccharides, disaccharides, glycerol, break them down into their single units. Those then are converted into acetate and other short-chain fatty acids by acetogenic bacteria. And ultimately, the CO2 and hydrogen and the methanogens there down at the very bottom then will convert that into methane. And so you can see there's this progression of passage, essentially, of hydrogen down this chain as these compounds are broken down. And again, it's the community of organisms that exists within the rumen that allows this to happen. And I would say that the community that exists there is actually not unlike the same types of communities that occur out in the sediments, out in the environment, that are carrying out essentially the same type of biochemical processes. So we have some sequencing data now, and I say we meaning the scientific community in general, has some sequencing data now down into these populations of bacteria that exist in these environments. Some of these organisms have been known for some time by studying through cultivation-based methods in which the organisms are actually cultivated and grown and studied in the laboratory. That was the traditional way of studying them. Now with this new tool of DNA sequencing, we have the ability to study them in a culture-independent fashion, so you don't have to culture them. We can use sequencing, and I'll show you in a little bit a little more detail about how we do it. But we can use that sequencing now to drill down into these populations and ask which organisms are there and how abundant are they and all these types of questions you'll see here. This is an early paper from Isaac's group in Israel, just drilling down into how much diversity, asking how many different species of microbes do we have in the ruminant environment. And this is, I believe, from about 16 animals, if I remember correctly. And these are basically collector's curves, and so it's if I sequence down deep enough in the population and I keep reaching into that sequence, at what point do I start to level off? And you can see there on panel A there on top, you start to level off at about around 4,000 to 5,000 different OTUs. And now you're going to see this pop up frequently. That OTU stands for Operational Taxonomic Unit. And what that means is it's something we probably think is a species. Okay? We don't know that it's a species, but we think it's a species. And we think it's that because these sequences are about 97% identical. That's the magic number that we use for bacteria. So we don't know what it is. We think it's probably a species, so we call it an operational taxonomic unit. So it looks like there may be about 5,000 or so species, bacterial species, that are represented within the ruminant environment. And if you look down at the graph below, that's a similar type of graph now that's plotted. The one above is sort of an average across a number of animals. Down below, we see the plots for individual animals. And what you'll find, if you look at the graph on the right, is there you're looking at the percentage of these O2Us in how many animals you find them in. And so what you find is that there's actually a lot of these species of bacteria that are only found in a few animals. So they're very sparsely distributed. And there's a few species that are common to a lot of the animals. And I'm laying this up there now because it's going to come up later on in the talk now. But this is the type of distribution that we find. And so those species that are sparsely distributed, and you may find them at high levels in one animal, you may not find them at all in another animal. And we think a lot of that may have to do with this functional redundancy that's built into the genome of these bacteria. So there may be five different species of bacteria that you can carry out a given biochemical function, and it may not, at least to some degree, it may not matter so much which one you have as long as you have one of them. So that's probably part of the explanation for this phenomenon that we see. So there's a small core of organisms that are essentially shared across most animals, and there's a vertebrate a large number of sparsely distributed species. If you look at the core, and this is from that same paper, I'll try to list it. If you look at that core, that's shown on the right whisker plots of the distribution of those core, and that should be the log proportion scale on the bottom. But those are Boston whisker plots showing you that even within the core, you have a wide range of abundances. And again, get used to looking at these plots because you're going to see a few of them coming up here in the data later on. So there's the core that's found among the 16 animals, and they're colored by the taxonomic group in which these organisms belong to. So one of the questions that we have, at least in studying the ecosystem in general, the gut ecosystem in general, and of course it's important and relevant to the bovine environment, and that is, what are the factors that shape the assembly? So how does this complex community actually assemble? And so there's a few different factors, and the N is very small here, the factors that have been studied in the bovine model. But here's one of the first studies looking at the temporal succession and how these communities evolved. And what you find if you look at the colored graph there on the left is that early in life, very shortly after birth, these animals are dominated by members of the proteobacteria. And then over time, then, we start to see the rumen filling in with populations of Acteroides and populations of the Clostridia. The Clostridia belong to the Firmicutes. And those are the organisms that are doing much of the hydrolytic activity in that top part of the nutritional hierarchy. So early on in life, and the same phenomenon actually occurs in mice, and the same phenomenon occurs in humans. Early in life, we see domination by some of these proteobacteria, and then they get replaced over time by the members that are more what we would call autochthonous members of that environment, meaning those that have these. These are the organisms that are actually selected for being there in that environment. Now, probably a lot of the reason for that has to do with how anaerobic that environment becomes. At least that's been the explanation for what we believe is happening in humans and mice, is that early in life, that environment is not quite completely anaerobic. And as the animals or humans get older, that environment becomes very anaerobic, and at that point, then you switch over and you start favoring the obligate anaerobic organisms that belong to the Bacteroides and belong to the Clostridium. And again, we come back to this compartmentalization issue. If you look at the distribution of organisms that you find in the rumen versus the organisms that you find in the colon in particular, and I would say just focus on the right-hand part of that nice little red and blue colored chart. What you find, so each of those columns there is an individual animal, so there's four different animals. And each of the row there, each row is a different organism, and the blue to red color is its relative abundance. And so what you find is that when you look in the rumen versus looking in the colon, you find very different relative abundances of the organism. So if you look at the pie chart there on A, you'll find that that in the, it should be the upper part. Yeah, an upper part of the rumen, you find high levels of Firmicutes. When you get down into the colon, then that proportion of those organisms starts to shift. So different proportions of these organisms. We believe that in general, probably a lot of the microbiome that exists in the colon is probably inoculated from what's coming from the oropharynx all the way through the rumen down into the colon. So that's likely its origin, but the proportions of these organisms probably shift because it's a different niche. Right? It's an entirely different niche in the colon, especially in the colon in bovine, as compared to monogastric animals. We have the compartmentalization, we have the temporal succession, and then we have the question of breed, and again, the N is very, very small, but in a couple of studies now, there's been comparisons of dairy cattle and beef cattle, and that's about the best we can get for breed at this point, the effects of breed on microbiome content. But certainly you do see breed specific differences if you group them into those two broad categories in the distribution of the microbiome. So in the principal component plot that's shown on the left there, the beef animals are C and D, and the dairy animals are up there in B. And then if you look at the beef, whether they're on starch or whether they're on high protein diets, again, you start to see some differences there. So you can see the dietary components that influence that along with the potential for breed. I want to come back to this phenomenon again of what the microbiome looks like. We shared before that there's a large number of species that are sparsely distributed, and there's this small core that's long-normally distributed, because this, like I said, is a phenomenon that we see not only in cattle, but we see this in humans and in mice. And at this point, then, this is when I'm going to switch over now and start talking about mice. And the reason is because it's much easier to do these genetic studies in mice, and we can do them much faster, and we can do them certainly a lot cheaper than we can do them in cattle. So we've done a lot of our discovery work for how this, just the very fundamentals of how this ecosystem functions, by studying mouse model systems. So I want to tell you a little bit about the things we found in mice, and then I'll come back here when I'm done with that, and we'll talk about the translation of that into the bovine environment. So we started off looking at simple intercross models, and what's great about this audience, oftentimes I don't have the luxury of speaking to people that know animal genetics. So this time there's a lot of people in the audience that know animal genetics, so I don't have to spend a lot of time talking about that. I have to spend more time talking about the microbiome. But this was an intercross model that we began with. This is a collaboration I developed with Daniel Pomp. And he was right in the middle of a particular intercross experiment that he was doing. He had a large number of progeny coming out the other end. And we essentially phenotyped those progeny and asked the question, can we actually see genetic components, or can we actually see genetic effects on composition of the microbiome? And the way we did that was to phenotype the gut microbiota, and now I'm going to give you a little bit of detail without killing you on how we go about doing this, or at least how we did it at the time. It's since changed that time. But when the DNA sequencing technology had come out, the approach that we were able to use was to take fecal samples and extract whole DNA from those fecal samples. Most of the DNA that comes out of those fecal samples is bacterial DNA. And we then used the polymerase chain reaction, and we used primers that were specific for the 16S ribosomal RNA gene. And this is a gene that's conserved across all bacteria. Every bacterial species has it. And it's actually a gene upon which much of the taxonomy of bacterial species has now been built since the 1980s or so. So we know an awful lot about this gene. We know a lot of microorganisms by this gene. And if we can just sequence this particular gene down through a population of bacteria, we can take those individual sequences and almost assign them to a given bacterial taxa, and we can then quantify the relative abundances of the different microorganisms in these animals. And so the way we did that was to, as I said, use the 16S ribosomal RNA gene as a PCR target. We PCR'd and amplified that gene in individual samples from about 800 different animals in the experiment. And those PCR primers then had tails on them that could be used for sequencing. And within those tails, we built in a specific barcode, each one specific to a sample. So every sequence that came out of this experiment, I could tell from the barcode which animal it actually belonged to. So we can let the computer sort everything out for us. So we can do all these reactions individually. We can then mix everything together, and I'm not going to bore you with how the sequencers work, but we can mix all this stuff together, all the products together, throw them onto the sequencer, generate a lot of sequences. We went about 10,000 sequence reads into each animal, or the microbiome from each animal. So just think of it like reaching in and grabbing 10,000 marbles out of the marble jar and counting the colors that are there in the marble jar. That's about what we're doing here. It's a little more difficult, but that's essentially what we're doing. And we're being able to do that across all these different animals. Just quickly, and again, I don't want to bore you with the details here, but the data processing isn't quite as trivial as just counting marbles. Because dealing with that many sequence reads, it was 5.6 million sequence reads, and we ended up with an average of 8,000 across the first animal set. But it's a fairly complex computational pipeline that we had to put together that would allow us to assign taxonomic status to those reads. And again, I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but the only thing I want to point out on this slide is that the first study that we did only used a part of that pipeline that's shown in the circle there, because that was all the farther along we were at that point. You're going to see a couple of diagrams here in a second, and those diagrams represent the whole thing, whether we've done only part of it or whether we've used the entire thing. If we use only part of this processing pipeline, we could only classify about 50% of the sequences that came out of this experiment. The other 50% we couldn't classify, so we set them aside in the initial experiment. So this shows you the distribution again, and hopefully I've been printing this on your minds now. If you walk out of here and remember anything of it today, you'll remember that what these distributions look like. There's a very large number. Well, I wish the pointer would work here. There's a very large number of sparsely distributed taxa and a small number of core taxa. It's exactly what we observed when we did this experiment some time ago. So that heat map that's shown on the upper left there, that shows the different cohorts of animals that were coming off of the breeding waves. I think there's 700 different columns in that particular heat map, each one representing a different animal. Yellow means the organism was abundant, and black means it wasn't detected. And there's about 100 rows. These are only the 100 most abundant organisms that we found in these particular animals. And you'll see that just look at the yellow, that there's a relatively small number of taxa that are shared across all those animals. And in fact, if you look at the 709 animals that had useful data that we actually used and went forward with the experiment, there's 420 genera that we observed in at least one animal. Okay, so we found 420 different genera of bacteria in at least one animal. But if you look at the taxa that were present in greater than 75% of the animals, that left us at 19. So that's a relatively small core of organisms that we were actually using. So those 19 we used as actual phenotypes then in our experiment. Those 19 and then some of the higher taxonomic classifications of those 19 are shown in the box and whiskers plot there on the right. And you see they're log normally distributed across the population, and those are the traits then that we use. We treated them as traits, just like you would any other quantitative trait in our experiments. And remember I told you would see two of these wheels. So here's the one wheel on the left. That's what we call a taxonomy-based microbiome analysis. That was that first part of the pipeline. And what we found there was 18 different QTLs, quantitative trait loci, that we were able to make significant associations with segments of the genome, and the genomic segments are shown around the outside in a ring, in a concentric ring. And anywhere where we found a significant association, you'll see a red line through the ring, the different SNP markers that we use are the little gray lines through those rings. And then the confidence interval around the QTL is shown with a rectangle, and the color of that confidence interval corresponds to the dendrogram, which is the phylogenetic tree of the microorganisms that we found in these animals, and that's shown in the center of the diagram there. And so the first thing that jumps out at you when you saw that, was that host-genetic control is exerted across the phylogenetic space that's represented by the microbiome, meaning that the host wasn't focusing its genetic control on one particular branch of that phylogenetic tree, but you see most of the colors of that phylogenetic tree are represented in those QTLs. So the animals are shaping, the host genetics is shaping that tree by impinging it from lots of different directions, not by focusing on one particular branch. The second thing we learned is that host genetic control is focused really at the tips of the branches, and that's on the genus and species level. And you can really see that if you look at the wheel on the right. So the wheel on the right is now all of the data, all of the microbiome data that's been included in the mapping. And each of those little individual bars in the middle, those are different OTUs. Remember what OTU stands for. Those are things we think are species. And we think they belong to the phyla that are represented by the colors. And you can see a lot of those, you see a lot more of those now. I think there's 57 different QTLs that we found when we used the species level OTUs as traits in our mapping experiment. Third one is that the architecture largely seemed to emphasize innate immune response. And I'm going to come back to talk about that in just a minute. But we didn't land on any of the big adaptive immune response loci in the mouse genome that we were expecting that we might find in the process. And I'll come back and talk about that in a minute. So second question we've had now, as we've moved on, is to start asking now, start building the model up, and that is now, can we see whether a diet has any interactions with host genetics? And so the same population of animals now, the same series of advanced intercrossed lines. The previous mapping I showed you was done in generation 4. This particular mapping was done in generation 10, so they expanded the lines again in generation 10, and we split the animals randomly. Half of the animals were on a high-fat diet immediately after weaning. The other half of the animals were put on a conventional diet. They were on that diet for 8 weeks, and at the end of that 8-week period, then we collected fecal samples from the individual animals, and we removed a segment of the ileum. Obviously, these were animals who were terminated at the experiment. So keep that in mind. We got a chunk of the ileum, and we've got fecal samples from the same animal, all the animals in this experiment. So the first question then was if we now go through and we do the microbiome mapping, just like I showed you in the previous sample, and now we include diet into the model, what we found was that there were several different QTLs that affected the microbiota. We also found at least 4 different QTLs that had gene-by-diet interactions, meaning that diet was modifying the genetic effect of the affected QTLs at these particular loci. And you can see this better on this these two graphs right here. These are just a couple of them. These are two of the QTLs, two different QTLs, I should say, on chromosome 1. And the haplotype of the QTL, the homozygous for one parent, HRHR, is on the left. Homozygous for the V6 parent is on the right of column of those graphs. And the heterozygote is in the middle. And these are two different, one is an OTU, and the other is a member of Pterococcus, a species of Pterococcus, shown on the right. But you can see that depending upon which diet these animals had, the impact of the haplotype of the QTL is influenced. And so this is the first instance now where we've seen that diet can potentially modulate the effects of host genetics, at least at these individual loci.